This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. To help slow the spread of COVID-19, health experts are encouraging people again to celebrate the holiday at home without bringing together multiple households. For a lot of people, that would mean a solo holiday. But after a long year of isolation, the idea of being by ourselves, say for Christmas or Hanukkah, might not feel like something we want to do. Our next guest has some advice on how to keep our spirits up while we're alone this season. Shyla Morgain is a distinguished psychologist specializing in health psychology at UW Health. Shyla, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It's such an important topic.
And it sounds like, as I read up on this, one key, if we're going to have a holiday alone, is to kind of plan ahead of time, not to be caught on the day of realizing, oh, this is a bummer. I'm all alone and I don't know what I'm going to do. How important is it to come up with a plan for our holidays?
Absolutely. Combating social isolation and loneliness is really key to well-being during this holiday season. There are health implications if we become too lonely and isolated. So really having a plan of who you want to connect with in what way, at what time, can make sure that you don't have those unoccupied moments where you might be vulnerable to experiencing the holiday blues.
One key here, Shyla, it seems to me, is I think every year there might be people dealing with loneliness, even around the holidays, and they might think, this is just me. I'm all alone and feeling alone. That's not true ever. It's really not true this year, though, is it? A lot of people are going to be dealing with these issues.
Absolutely. The holidays typically can be quite stressful, but this year it looks so different and we're not able to access some of our favorite traditions. We're not able to see some of the people we look forward to during this time of year. And as a result, it can be a really challenging time. So I'm also encouraging, in addition to having that plan of people you want to connect with virtually or your favorite activities, to really practice emotional fitness. You know, here in Wisconsin, it's the winter. We're vulnerable to the winter blues. So it's really important to prioritize taking care of yourself, sleeping well, eating healthy foods, getting regular exercise, managing your stress through mindfulness or relaxation, and also really cultivating your joy. I think these days leading up to the holidays, we can think about doing one simple thing simply for our joy to really boost our mood.
I know it can be hard when a person's in the midst of feeling like that, the isolation, the loneliness, the sadness. It can be hard to come up with that plan, to figure out what's going to give you joy. How can we get that initial spark of motivation to make sure we do take care of ourselves?
Well, I think one thing to keep in mind is this year we don't have to do all those things that were those expectations. We don't have to drive a long way in the sleet or snow to go to a family member's house we weren't really looking forward to. So instead, give yourself permission to play by your own rules. You can create this holiday any way you want. You can wear pajamas all day or eat some favorite foods in moderation or watch a show you've been looking forward to. So get creative and think outside the box. And, you know, again, there's a silver lining that this holiday season could be quite memorable because it might open up ways of doing new things. And a little bit of solitude, if we choose it, if it's more of a choice, can be actually quite enriching. We often are so busy that we lose touch with our inner voice. And having a little bit of spaciousness can help us come home to ourselves. And I call this active solitude, actively taking time for yourself, take a walk in nature, do a little meditation, get a good night's sleep. All that stuff can be really nurturing and soothing this time of year.
Talking to Shyla Morgain, a distinguished psychologist at UW Health, about how to approach the holidays if we're celebrating in smaller groups than we're used to, maybe even solo, and how to make the most of it. Shyla, for people who are going to have a phone call or a video meeting with friends or family on the holidays, how do we make sure it's not just another in a long series of these pandemic calls or Zoom meetings or whatever? How can we make it a little more special?
That's a great question. Zoom fatigue is real. We can start to burn out and find it draining. And so thinking about, are there creative ways to have a call? Could you do a board game through Zoom or maybe have a holiday scavenger hunt where everyone's getting items and sharing pictures? Or maybe you're having a ugly sweater competition and everyone's showing off their new sweater or their funny sweater. If you have kids, you could have them connect with their cousins and do some games or do do a charade, show and tell. Again, you know, there's so many different ideas. But I think if we're just sitting in front of the screen chatting for half an hour with multiple people, that can feel quite draining. And it can be an opportunity to connect family all across the country all together and even share a meal. I know for Thanksgiving, and I'm hearing people doing this for Hanukkah and Christmas, they're doing the same dish but at different households and trying to see, is it, you know, similar to grandma's favorite casserole or grandpa's favorite cookies, and showing off their decorations and that same dish in the creative way that they've prepared it. So think outside the box, but it can, again, create memories that really bond us during this time and help us feel not so alone.
Flipping things around, how important is it for people to make sure that those people who might be spending a holiday alone are on their radar and to reach out to them?
This is so important. I think of two ways. First, if you know somebody who's single or living on their own, reach out to them and ask them specifically how they're doing and what they need during this time of year, and then create a plan. Ask them what kind of support, how they want to stay connected to you. And what we're doing here is we're really creating a sense of meaning. One of the things that can stabilize and boost our mood is in generosity of giving to other people. So reach out to those single people, those people living alone. And even if you are living alone, a great way to feel connected to humanity and others is to give the gift of generosity. Reach out to a neighbor, donate to a cause that's important to you, or bring a meal and leave it outside somebody's doorstep of somebody else in your neighborhood who might be struggling. And lastly, know you're not alone. And if you are feeling depressed or abusing substances or feeling really anxious or having trouble sleeping, please reach out for help, calling your doctor or reaching out to see a behavioral health specialist for additional support and guidance.
Shyla, thanks so much for sharing this advice with us today.
It's been a pleasure, and happy holidays.
To you too. Shyla Morgane is a distinguished psychologist specializing in health psychology at UW Health. We talked to her today about making the holidays less lonely, even if you're spending them alone. Coming up, we'll hear about a UW-Madison program that's connecting rural school districts around the state with special education teachers in high demand. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Attracting and retaining enough teachers can be challenging for rural school districts in Wisconsin. That's especially true when it comes to special education teachers. A program at UW-Madison is looking to help fill that need by connecting students and new teachers with those schools. Started in 2018, the UW Special Education Teacher Residency Program allows students to complete their master's work while teaching in rural schools and provides incentives for committing to a school for consecutive years. Kimber Wilkerson is a professor in the UW-Madison School of Education and director of the school's Teacher Education Center. Kimber, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
How big a problem is a shortage of special education teachers for Wisconsin schools, especially in these rural districts?
Well, there's been a challenge across the nation and in Wisconsin also specifically in attracting people to the field of special education. So rural districts can feel that challenge sometimes more severely than more populated areas because they may have fewer applicants or fewer qualified people who apply for their openings. So I think they can feel it, like I said, even though openings in special education are kind of pervasive, but it can feel especially challenging in rural settings.
And in a small district, as I understand it, you know, if one special education teacher is retiring, that might be a big problem. There's not a big staff to help fill that gap while they're replacing that position, right?
Yes. So we have several of our partner districts where the entire district is located in one school, and there may be only one or two special educators in that school. So, yes, a turnover of one staff member can be a pretty significant challenge.
The Special Education Teacher Residency Program. Give us the basics of how this works.
So our program starts in a summer, continues through an entire academic year, and ends in a following summer, so essentially a year. But during this, I think one of the really unique settings about this is that Our students are in a one-year residency in a partner district. So they agree to and know up front that they're going to work in one of these rural districts. They meet the people ahead of time, the superintendent, the principal, whoever else they're going to work with, and they commit to learning and growing in that setting for the entire academic year, and also agree to work in that district upon their graduation.
And this is funded, as I understand it, by a grant from the U.S. Department of Education. What has that allowed the program to do so far?
Yeah, so the funding is through the U.S. Department of Education under a program called the Teacher Quality Partnership Grants. And these target specifically high-need districts. And so here in Wisconsin, we chose to focus on small rural districts and special education specifically. But a big thing that it has allowed us to do is it provides funding for living stipends. So sometimes changing careers or going to school as an adult, you might, a returning adult, it may be more difficult to have a full-time residency where you're learning full-time and going to school in the evening if you also have to maintain a job. So between the ability to provide a modest living stipend and then combined with some other tuition incentives that we have, we're able to kind of reduce a lot of the financial barriers that people might have to returning to school.
Another part of the story is you work with teachers to commit to staying in a particular school district for a few years. How does that work and what do they get out of that?
Well, one of the things that's really lovely about this program is that because they commit this one-year residency, so by residency, I mean they are working with a certified special educator in one of our partner districts, you know, every day, all year, all academic year. But they really get to know the staff there. And in a small rural district, it can be very different than working in a suburban or urban district because sometimes you have to learn how to be a jack of all trades. You also develop, you know, relationships with families that might be different than the relationships you would develop in other kinds of school districts. So there are some unique elements and people get to live that and see that. And I think learning in this setting, when you know you're going to work in that setting when you graduate, is a special incentive for the school district to really care about your preparation and be invested in your preparation because they know you're going to be their colleague in the next year for several years thereafter.
And are you hoping to expand this, to work with more, to bring more people into special education and then to get them into rural districts?
Yeah, we have, you know, this program has allowed us to kind of reimagine, or the funding has helped us to be able to reimagine the ways that we're preparing our master's students. And we've been, as other districts have heard about the program and inquired about whether they might be able to be included in the partnership. Of course, our grant funding focuses on our identified partner districts, but we're just now starting to talk to three other slightly larger but still rural districts about what this might be able to look like in their own districts. So exploring how our financial incentives through our tuition, the teacher pledge might be able to help, and also what we might be able to do collaboratively, because a lot of times districts have people who work in their own communities who they might want to invest in to become a special educator in their building and in their district. And so we want to try to partner with them to see how we can tailor our program and kind of expand it to include other districts beyond just these initial 14 partners.
Kimber, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Kimber Wilkerson is a professor in the UW-Madison School of Education, director of the school's Teacher Education Center. She joined us for a look at UW's Special Education Teacher Residency Program, connecting students and new teachers with rural school districts around the state. Coming up, if you or your kids watched any TV in the 80s and 90s, there's a good chance that involves some programming from Nickelodeon. We'll talk to the directors of a new documentary that tells the story of the rise of the Kids First TV channel. First, it's the Wisconsin Public Radio year-end membership drive. Bill Martins is with me. This is your chance to support the programs you count on every day on the Ideas Network. Your gift now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 is so important as we end this year and look forward to 2021.
And we have a dollar-for-dollar match in effect right now from current members, including a member in Elkhart Lake. So your gift of $50 turns into $100, $100 turns into $200, and so on. And we've got about $2,400 left on the table. So let's not let any of that go to waste. Take advantage of this match and double your support for Wisconsin Public Radio programs when you give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Just over the last half hour, we've had great conversations. A psychologist here in Wisconsin offering advice for dealing with the smaller holiday gatherings or spending the holidays on your own during the pandemic. Then a look at a real effort to solve a problem, a concern about the ability of smaller rural school districts in the state to keep special education teachers on staff. These are examples of the kind of Wisconsin expertise, the efforts to solve problems, personal and large scale problems. These are the kind of conversations you can count on from Central Time.
And WDPR is listener supported. That means that your donation at WDPR.org or 888-202-2552 makes the many topics you tune in for every day possible. Choose an amount that works for you and then make your gift.
Get that gift matched when you give. And this member drive, you can also choose the Reach Out and Read thank you gift when you give $10 a month or more. When you do that, you'll provide books to children during their doctor visits. Another great reason to make your gift right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
That's 888-202-2552. We've got that dollar-for-dollar match in effect, and we've got still about $2,400 left to for that match. So plenty of room to have your pledge, to have your gift doubled, and it will go to support a great thing like Wisconsin Public Programming, which you depend on each and every day. Give now at WDPR.org or 888-202-2552, and your support will go twice as far.
Sorry to jump in there, Bill.
That's okay.
Count on Wisconsin Public Radio for great conversations each and every day. We count on you to help pay for it. Now is a great time to do that with a gift getting matched right now, a dollar-for-dollar match in effect. Make your gift, get it matched at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And thank you so much for your support. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Do you remember, or maybe your kids or grandkids remember, changing the channel and hearing something like this?
Nick, 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 Nickelodeon. Nick, 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 Nickelodeon.
That was a classic bumper from what became an iconic kids television channel, Nickelodeon. Writers and directors Scott Barber and Adam Sweeney set out to tell the story of the rise of Nickelodeon from its beginnings as an early experiment in cable TV to a booming multimedia powerhouse in the 80s and 90s. Their new documentary is called The Orange Years, The Nickelodeon Story. It was just released last month. Scott and Adam, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, we're happy to be here.
Great. Well, for those listeners who maybe didn't grow up, I was a little too early for Nickelodeon, but my brother was right in the sweet spot. Give us a nutshell of Nickelodeon and why, let's start with you, Scott, why you wanted to tell its story.
You know, Nickelodeon, it was so important to so many people. It was certainly important to Adam and I. And a little bit of backstory, Adam and I have actually been friends since we watched these shows as little kids, since the early 90s. So it was very important to us both in our separate lives and part of our friendship. So we knew that, you know, when you would bring these shows up to people, it struck a chord with people always throughout our lives. You know, when you bring up, hey, dude, Salute Your Shorts, Are You Afraid of the Dark? We always noticed there was this really strong reaction from, you know, millennials and Generation Xers. So we knew this was a really important story to tell that a lot of people would really connect to.
And Adam, watching the documentary, I get the sense that people who were involved in the early days, the suits and the stars alike, this is a really big deal in their lives. They seem to really like talking about their experience in those early days.
Yeah, they were very open and eager and also very thankful for this part of the story to be told, because everybody generally gets to see who the wizard or the Wizards of Oz are, but not a lot of people get to see whenever the curtain is pulled back. And you know, from Jody Laybourne to Ann Sweeney to Vanessa Coffey, to just name a few, everybody was so gracious and so kind and just gave us access to not only archival footage, but to interviews that really were unprecedented. And so it was exciting for us because we were really getting to kind of see what the recipe was for this phenomenal success.
Well, I want to give a listen to a piece of the documentary here. You mentioned the name Geraldine Laybourne. She ran Nickelodeon for a couple of decades there. And we're going to hear from Alan Goodman, a creative executive there, talking about a meeting where the attitude, I think, of Nickelodeon was really crystallized. Here's a listen.
And then Jerry's son, Sam, came through the living room at one point with a very typical 8-year-old's lament. Jerry watched as he left, and she said, "Boy, it's tough to be a kid." We realized, almost every one of us, almost instantly, that there was tremendous value and dignity in letting kids be kids.
Scott, can you talk about that attitude and how it shaped Nickelodeon after some early, I think, stumbles in the approach they took, how it shaped their vision for what kids' TV would look like?
Yeah, and I love that moment, you know, because it's so true. I think someone originally said that, man, it's so tough to be a kid sarcastically, because from an adult's point of view, kids have it so easy. But then when you really stop and think about it, no, they don't. Being a kid is really tough. You know, the things that are important to them, they may not be important to us, but they're certainly important to kids. And every bit of their life is controlled by somebody else, where they eat, what they do, everything. So, you know, I think when they had that aha moment that, wow, being a kid actually is tough and kids deserve dignity and they deserve something awesome. I think that's just such a beautiful moment in the history of Nickelodeon. And I think it was interesting for Adam and I doing research. You know, we remember mainly what we call the orange years, which was, you know, the Salute Your Shorts, the Hey Dudes, the Clarissa, when Nickelodeon was really popping. You know, they were really making they really had their own identity. So it was fun to get to go back and learn about this time when they kind of didn't understand things yet, when they were kind of creating things that kids really didn't want. That was very fascinating for us to learn about and to kind of see how once they really tried to understand children in an open and authentic way, that's whenever they got that lightning in a bottle.
And Adam, can you talk about how that translated onto the screen from that? I think somebody called it the Eat Your Veggies era in the early days of Nickelodeon, where it was stuff that adults thought that kids needed to see. And then the switch was flipped to no, what kids want to see and what they're going to enjoy.
Yeah. I think that a lot of the green vegetable years, as Scott Webb calls them, were showcasing talented teenagers and children. There were child prodigies that were supermodels, that were the next Mozart. And, you know, I think a lot of adults think that that is what children want to strive to see or to be. But the reality is that makes you feel pretty horrible because you can't relate to it at all, right? Most of us are somewhere in the middle. We're the Doug Funnies of the world. And so once they started taking a look at and really paying attention to, as Geraldine Laybourne talks about, what it means to be a kid, they realize that, you know, most of us deal with the same things whenever we're adults as we do whenever we're children, which are we want to be accepted. We go through the pains and the trials of sometimes breakups, being bullied, moving around and finding out what those transitional periods are. And so that's really what informed creating Clarissa Explains It All and Hey Dude and The Adventures of Pete and Pete. And once they did that, and then they really started focusing on having talent that looked and reflected the ideals of children, that was whenever they found kind of their secret sauce.
We're talking to Adam Sweeney and Scott Barber, writers and directors of the new documentary, The Orange Years, The Nickelodeon Story. Let's get into some of the specific shows, Scott, and one key moment, one key turning point was this Canadian show they brought on board. You can't do that on television. It brought the slime onto the network. Talk about how that helped define what Nickelodeon was going to be.
Yeah, it really did define them, didn't it? And it's funny, you know, a lot of people don't remember that there was a time when Nickelodeon didn't create any shows. All their shows were licensed from other people, from Canadian shows, from French shows, from British shows, you know, like Danger Mouse and Banana Man. And they stumbled upon this very small, low budget show called You Can't Do That on Television. And when they aired that, it was like, boom, kids connected to it in a big way. And for those that, you know, that don't remember it, it was really kind of like Monty Python for kids. It had a very absurdist, bizarre, tongue-in-cheek, irreverent sense of humor. And you can see that that show really informed Nickelodeon what they would do for the next basically two decades, you know, where not just, I mean, like you said, that's where the green slime came from. But it's also where Nickelodeon would kind of develop that habit of pushing things right to the limit without crossing the line, you know, being just naughty enough without being obscene, you know, like that you would see on like Ren and Stimpy and Rocco's Modern Life and lots of shows like that. You know, they developed that. And there's also another trope that they would do where the adults were always dumb and the kids were smart, because that's how kids feel. You know, they look at adults and they're like, what's wrong with these bozos, you know? So yeah, that show completely changed everything for Nickelodeon and definitely helped. You can definitely see that they modeled a lot of shows after that throughout the 80s and throughout all the 90s as well.
Another show that you mentioned, Adam, that was a key turning point was some scripted programming here. Hey Dude, I want to give a listen to your documentary and Ann Sweeney, former senior vice president of Program Enterprises, talking about Hey Dude.
It's a little wild and a little strange when you make your home out on the range.
Hey Dude was a critical moment for Nickelodeon to do a scripted show, to do something that other networks did. They did scripted television. So it was critical that this was written for kids.
Adam, can you talk about a Nickelodeon tackled the challenge of their own scripted programming for kids?
Of course. They obviously were on to something very special, because Graham Yost and Lisa Melamed have gone on to create tons of wonderful stories like Band of Brothers, Speed. And, you know, it was not without their own challenges, to be clear, because they, you know, were out and shooting in, you know, on a dude ranch in sometimes 126 degree weather. And so they had to rely on a lot of classic tropes. They had to rely on a lot of classic storylines. But one of the things that you can see if you go and revisit Hey Dude is that there was and I think Nickelodeon in general, is that there was a genuine positivity and sweetness and kindness within the story, right? There were obviously rivalries, you know, but it was all friendly. And at the end of the day, like many sitcoms that we, you know, keep near and dear to our hearts, always ended with a, you know, a happy ending. And so I think that Hey Dude really informed them on figuring out what was next. In a lot of ways, as Scott kind of alluded to, it very much is analogous to You Can't Do It on Television and paved the way for the success of all of the ones that would later on precede it.
I don't have too much time left, and you spend so much time on a lot of different shows. I want to throw to each of you, pick out one show that either meant something to you as a kid or that struck you in the making of the documentary as a pivotal one that we haven't talked about. Scott, let's start with you.
You know, one show that I always loved as a kid, but I got an even deeper reverence for after making this documentary, is Doug. You know, I think Doug a lot of times gets overlooked because the other two original Nicktoons, Ren and Stimpy and Rugrats, became such huge, big things. And Doug kind of sometimes gets overlooked. And it's just such an amazing show. And it really, I think, does a great job of navigating that, being an 11-year-old person, even though it is cartoony and it's abstract. I think it just does such a great, great job of exploring what a kid's life is like at that age when you're not the nerd and you're also not the most popular. You're just somewhere in between. It's a lot more realistic than I think a lot of 80s shows were, where everyone had to be a stereotype or a trope. And Jim Jenkins, they say it in the doc, he really is the nicest, sweetest man in the entire world. So that guy deserves all the credit and accolades that we could throw at him. Doug, just such a good show.
And how about you, Adam?
I'd pick two female-led stories would be Clarissa Explains It All and The Secret World of Alex Mack. I have even more appreciation of the ground that they paved or broke. they paved it and broke it. And I just have so much appreciation for Melissa Joan Hart and Larissa Olenek, and the ability to have gender equality and have female leaders, in addition with Geraldine Laybourne and her crew, at a time period when it wasn't happening and it wasn't necessarily the popular or trendy thing to do. So I would definitely recommend all of those. And then, of course, like Scott said, we all love Doug.
We'll leave it there. Scott and Adam, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Thanks a lot. Stay orange.
Scott Barber and Adam Sweeney are the writers and directors of the new documentary, The Orange Years, the Nickelodeon story. We talked to them about their project. It was released last month.